Welcome to Quinn's Empowerment Hour on the BBS Radio Network, hosted by Quinn Lay Erickson, psychotherapist, life coach, and inspirational speaker. Quinn's experience as a blind woman, a boat person from Vietnam, and a refugee has driven her to realize her dream to help you to become the best that you can be. So join Quinn every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time, for an hour of insight and inspiration for your heart, your spirit, and your soul. Good evening, this is Quinn's Empowerment Hour with Quinn Lay Erickson. Thank you for joining me tonight. Last week was Valentine's Day. So did you have a wonderful time with your partner or your spouse? Or do you have a good sexual connection with your partner or your spouse? Or perhaps some of you were disappointed sexually. Some of you may have felt rejected or lonely sexually. Or some of you may have wished to have some tips to improve your sex life. Today's show might be very informative and helpful for you, because in the Quinn's Empowerment Hour show, I often hope to bring to you different perspectives and to discuss all kinds of topics. And so today we are going to talk about sex and sexuality from different perspectives and on a wide range of, well, on a few topics given the limited time. So we talk about sexless marriage or sex-starved marriage. We are also going to talk about oral sex and how you can improve your oral sex, sexual fetish, sexual fantasies, and addiction to pornography. So first, I will start with a TED Talk done by Michelle Wiener Davis. And the title of the TED Talk is called Sex-Starved Marriage. So enjoy the clip.
So I'm going to talk to you about sex. To be more precise, the sex-starved marriage. And when I'm done, you'll know three things that you can do to prevent it from happening in your life. So first, I'd like to tell you a story. For the last three decades, I've been specializing in work with 911 couples, couples who are truly teetering on the brink of divorce. I resuscitate flatlined relationships. I try to teach couples what they need to know to resolve their differences and fall back in love and put their kids in bed at night together. It's not an easy job. But I didn't choose my career. My career chose me. You see, I grew up in an incredible family. Two loving parents who never fought, two great brothers, a large extended family with whom we spent every weekend and all of our holidays, until one fateful day, I was 16 years old and a senior in high school, and my mom called us all in for a family meeting, and she proceeded to tell us that she'd been miserable for 23 years in her marriage, and she was getting a divorce from my father. No one saw it coming. I told you, my parents never fought. I remember the feeling of blood rushing from my body, thinking, how could this be happening? I'm leaving home, and my nest is falling apart. And that's precisely what happened. Divorce not only ends a marriage, it dissolves a family. And the sadness about the breakup of my family still lingers today. That's because divorce is forever. Now, my parents' divorce affected me in a number of ways. First, it made me incredibly impassioned about learning everything I possibly could about how to have a healthy, loving, lasting relationship so I could apply it in my own life with my own family and my own marriage. And I'm very proud to say that one of my biggest accomplishments is my nearly 40-year marriage to my husband, Jim. And if you knew him, you'd know what an accomplishment this really is. The other thing my parents' divorce made me do is be incredibly impassioned about teaching what I know to anyone who crosses my path. Now, when I say that, I really mean that. I'm not just talking about the couples in my practice. I do some of my best work on airplanes or online at Whole Foods. Or as a matter of fact, that's why I'm here right now. I want to warn you about the inevitable pitfalls of a sex-starved marriage. But what is that? So, a sex-starved marriage is one where one spouse is desperately longing for more touch, more physical closeness, more sex, more physical affection. And the other spouse is thinking, what is the big deal? Would you just get a life? It's just sex. But to the spouse yearning for more sex and more touch, it's a huge deal because it really is about feeling wanted, about feeling loved, about feeling connected, about feeling masculine or feminine and attractive. And when this major disconnect happens, what also happens is that intimacy on all levels goes right out the door. They stop sitting next to each other on the couch. They quit laughing at each other's jokes. They don't spend time together. They stop being friends. And it places the marriage at risk of infidelity and divorce. Now, some of the reasons that people have low desire or an insatiable appetite for sex are very complicated and deep-seated. But I'm happy to tell you that the primary cause for a sex-starved marriage is also the simplest to solve. And before I explain that solution, I really want to go on record for saying that if you're sitting here thinking low sexual desire is a woman's issue, I want you to think again. Women do not have a corner on the low libido market. I'm convinced that low desire in men is one of our very best kept secrets. Now, having said that, I want to also tell you about a little talked about fact, and that is when it comes to a sex-starved marriage, the person with lower sex drive controls the sexual relationship. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that this person is intentionally mean-spirited or unkind or manipulative. I just mean if that person isn't interested in sex, the partner may as well go take a cold shower because it's not going to happen. Now, I find this really curious on a couple of counts, because when we think about how decisions are made in marriage, we generally think about mutuality. Two people decide when to get married, whether to have kids, how to raise those kids, what to do about the finances, the in-laws, who's going to do what around the house. But conspicuously missing from that mix is anything having to do with sex. What's it like, the nature, the quality, the quantity? I find this incredible. I know couples who have been married for 20 to 30 years who have never spoken about sex. The other thing that's really amazing to me about this unilateral decision making is one person decides no sex and expects the partner to accept it, not complain about it, and oh yes, you have to be monogamous. Now, this is an unworkable arrangement. Let me tell you about a couple in my practice. So meet John and Mary. They've been married for 15 years. And John's a real laid-back kind of guy, and he doesn't like to complain about much, except in the last 15 minutes of my session with him, he finally gets up the courage to tell me about something that had been bothering him for a long, long time. That there really is only a two-hour window of opportunity on Friday nights between 10 and 12 where Mary might be interested in sex, and he knows not to bother her at any other time. Like you, laughing, I glanced over at Mary, and Mary was chuckling because she recognized herself in that description. John wasn't laughing. He wasn't smiling. And so I said to him, John, what's this been like for you? And he said to me, I want to talk to Mary. He turned to her, took a deep breath, He said, when I reach out to you in bed and you're not there for me, the only thing I ever think about, are you attracted to me anymore? Do you love me like I love you? Do you want to be with me? And then when you go to sleep and I'm lying next to you and staring up at the ceiling, all I can think about is this is the loneliest feeling in the world, lying next to you in bed. And to Mary's credit, her eyes filled up with tears, and she reached out and grabbed John's hands. And she said, John, I have to tell you, in all the years we've been married, I never, not once, have thought about what it's like to be you. I only think about, am I in the mood? Am I not in the mood? I am so, so sorry. I'll do better. John began to cry. I began to cry. For me, it was a magical moment because it was the first time in the history of their marriage that Mary was stretching outside her comfort zone to try to understand John's pain, his loneliness, his alienation, his need to connect with her. And she promised she would do better. It was a beginning of a breakthrough for them. Unfortunately, for so many couples, it doesn't work that way. In fact, very often, the very thing that couples do to deal with a sex-starved marriage actually makes things worse. Let me give you an example. So he says, honey, do you want to put the kids to bed early tonight, have a glass of wine, and fool around? And she says, I have so much on my mind, I'm not relaxed, and I have a headache. You were the one to tell me last week that women are great multitaskers. Can't you have a headache and sex at the same time? I don't think you're funny. Furthermore, what part of no don't you get? Look, I'm not trying to be funny. I'm furious. We haven't had sex in 6 weeks. I hate this relationship. It's just not working. You raise your voice and you talk to me like that, and then you expect me to want to touch you? Plus, do you realize for the last 2 or 3 weeks you haven't been home at all? And when you are home, you don't talk to me, we don't do things together, you're angry and you're withdrawn. I am not going to have sex with you like that. I don't want to talk to you anymore. I'm out of here. So, what's going on here? I'll tell you what's going on. In the early stages of dealing with a sex-starved marriage, the person with higher desire usually approaches his or her spouse with open-heartedness and vulnerability, saying things like, I miss you, I want to have sex with you. But when those pleas for connection are met with unresponsiveness, like they often are, then that vulnerability quickly turns into anger and contempt. Anger is not an aphrodisiac. Anger leads to sexual withdrawal. Sexual withdrawal leads to heightened anger. Heightened anger leads to sexual anorexia. And on and on. And then both people wait for the other person to change. And that's how marriages go down the drain. So what are they supposed to do? Well, here's what they're supposed to do. He needs to get a grip on his anger, regardless of whether he feels shortchanged or not. Apparently, he needs to spend time with her and talk to her and be present in her life. He needs to recognize that it's those things that will turn her on. And what does she need to do? Well, despite her feelings, she needs to adopt the Nike philosophy and just do it. Why? For two reasons. The first is obvious. He'll be happy. He'll be nicer. He'll be more present. Mostly, he'll be more grateful. But there's another reason. It has nothing to do with him, and it's all about her. Look, I wish I had a dollar for each time someone in my practice said to me, Michelle, I wasn't in the mood for sex when my partner approached me, but once we got into it, I had a really good time. I had a great orgasm. We enjoyed each other. And then afterwards, we had the best conversation that we've had in months. And when I described that scenario to a couple in my practice, the husband said, yikes, that's my wife. I wish she would just write on her hand, I like sex, so she remembers it for the next time. So look, there's actually some science to this. I saw this so often in my practice that I started scouring the research, and I bumped into the work of Dr. Rosemary Basson, and she took the mystery out of my observations. So the human sexual response cycle is considered to have four stages. The first is desire, and this means that you could be doing just about anything, taking a walk, studying for a test, preparing a meal, talking to a friend, and all of a sudden you have this random lusty thought and you start fantasizing about sex. Second stage is arousal. You get with your partner, you get physically aroused, and you feel that sensation inside. The third stage, orgasm. Do you need an explanation? Fourth stage, resolution. Your body goes back to its normal resting state. Well, apparently, according to Dr. Basson's research, for millions of people, stages one, desire, and two, arousal, are actually reversed. That their bodies have to be physically stimulated and aroused in order for their brains to register there is desire. The desire is there, but it's not the compelling force to initiate sex. So, if this sounds like you or a friend of a friend, it behooves you to be receptive to your partner's advances, even from a neutral starting place, because once you get into it, you're bound to remember, I like sex. So, here's the deal. As human beings, we are hardwired for connection. We are learning through some groundbreaking research in social neuroscience that our need to connect with people we love is more fundamental and more basic than our need for food and shelter. And the opposite is also true, that disconnection hurts. I mean, get this. When scientists look into the functional MRIs of the brains of people who have just experienced a recent divorce or they're brokenhearted because of a breakup, the exact same regions of their brains light up as in the brains of people who are experiencing physical pain. And the same is not true for other negative emotions like sadness and anxiety and fear. Just for rejection. Rejection's unique. Rejection hurts. So when your partner comes over to you and says, I'm looking at this amazing sunset and I want to share it with you, or I just read this incredible article and I want you to read it, or can we just turn off our cell phones on Friday night so we can spend some time together uninterrupted? Or we haven't made love for a while, I'd love to snuggle in bed and make love to you. If we're not interested, if we're not in the mood, rejection hurts. So what are we supposed to do? Well, here are those three lessons I promised you in the beginning of my talk. Number one, we all have different ways of feeling connected to one another. We need to know our way, but we have to become experts in our partner's way of feeling connected to us. Number two, if you're with someone who's yearning for more touch and more physical closeness and more sex, don't delude yourself into thinking it's just sex, it's like scratching an itch. Sex is a powerful way of connecting and bonding with somebody you love. And number three, when you get your partner's way of connecting to you, you don't have to fully understand it. You don't have to fully agree with it. You just have to do it. And you want to know why? Two reasons. From everything I've learned about relationships, healthy relationships are based on mutual caretaking. Plus, it's an act of love. Now look, everyone, I know that what I'm asking you to do is really, really challenging because I'm asking you to put someone else's needs above your own. But I truly believe that if more of us took to heart the very crucial idea that we have to take better care of each other and that we don't have to be slaves to our own emotions, then we can make this world a more loving place. One marriage, one relationship at a time. People tell me that I'm a psychotic optimist, but I tell them that's okay. It's a communicable disease. Thank you.
You have just listened to a TED Talk titled Sex Starved Marriage by Michelle Wiener Davis. And now I'm very pleased to introduce to you a guest on our show tonight, Dr. Tisha Morgan, who is a sex therapist in the Vancouver area and who has recently co-authored a book called Heads Up, specifically about oral sex and blowjob. Do you want to increase your sexual confidence, expand your sexual repertoire, or get the real down low on oral sex? Why? Because when you know better, you blow better. Heads Up is an edgy yet educational, entertaining yet accurate book written by two clinical sex therapists and couples counselors on a mission to demystify and destigmatize sex and sexuality, specifically the blowjob. So here is Dr. Tisha Morgan. So I understand that you are in the process or you have already published a book. Can you tell us about that book?
Yes. Thanks for asking. I just published a book. It's called Heads Up. The website is headsupbook.com. Mm-hmm. And it's a book on oral sex, more specifically fellatio. And I just co-wrote it with a colleague of mine, Constance Lynn Hummel, who's also a therapist and couples counselor. The launch is actually this week, just in time for Valentine's Day. And the hard launch party, the official launch party, will be March 10th here in Vancouver. So, yes, we're very, very excited. It's been, again, quite the process and the journey, but we've been getting lots of great feedback, so we're quite happy about that.
What inspired you to write the book?
That's a good question. I think in my practice and in Constance's practice, we noticed that we were seeing a lot of couples and a lot of individuals that were coming in that had questions around oral sex or concerns or hang-ups or those sorts of things. And there, we didn't really think that there was a good resource to give them that wasn't either too stuffy, like too therapy-ish, like a Masters and Johnson kind of textbook style, or it was way out there in left field and very raw and liberal and maybe not for the faint of heart. We didn't really think there was anything in between. So we combined something that we thought was lots of tips and techniques and all-encompassing as far as knowledge goes. And that was also really funny and easy to read. But on the flip side, it also, the second part of the book or the last third or quarter of the book also has more of the therapy side behind it. So what to do if, you know, you're experiencing hang-ups with regards to oral sex or oral sex with your partner, either giving or receiving, and those sorts of things. So we thought it was a really good balance.
So this book, is it oriented more for men, women, or both?
We tried to make it gender neutral. Mm-hmm. So it's not a heteronormative book, meaning that it's written for a female to give a male oral sex. We really use terms like partner instead of going down on your boyfriend or husband or those sorts of things. We also wanted to make it inclusive for the trans community. Right. So we would use terms like male-bodied, for instance. Mm-hmm. So we really wanted to be encompassing for the LGBTQ community as well as, you know, married couples or those sorts of things, male-female couples.
Yeah. So can you give us some tips about how can we make oral sex for men, fellatio, fun for both women and men?
Yes, there's lots of tips in the book. I think we go through a wide variety, everything from the history of oral sex and things you really didn't know about, maybe how it got started and views in our culture, to more fun-related things like how food may impact oral sex, techniques with regards to your tenacity with going down on your partner, things like how pumpkin, the smell of pumpkin or lavender can actually increase penile blood flow by about 40%, kind of fun facts are peppered like that throughout. Mm-hmm. We also talk about some techniques that you normally wouldn't find in a book, like we call one the grapefruit technique, and it's about using a grapefruit while giving your partner oral sex. To have a tasty yet unusual sexual experience as well. So it's chock full of those kind of fun ideas.
Hmm. So this book would be quite a positive experience for a couple to read together.
Oh, definitely. Yes. It doesn't just have to be for one partner that's the giver. It can be for the partner that's the receiver as well to say, wow, like I've never even heard of, you know, whatever was on page 88. You know, I would really love to try that. Mm-hmm. And they can kind of laugh and look at it together. We also have a full chapter just on oral sex and blowjob positions. So if you, for instance, have a gag reflex or you feel like, you know, oral sex is uncomfortable because you're worried about choking, you and your partner can flip through the different positions, and there's sketches as well that are really well done and say, you know, well, let's try position number 3 because that might help with the gagging or make me more comfortable. Or so it can definitely be an inclusive book for couples as well.
What makes you really interested in emphasizing this part is a big part of sexual connection. So maybe you could tell us the benefits. Why would be interested in making an important part of the sexual intimacy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that, to say that everyone has to have oral sex and everyone has to perform oral sex and everyone has to enjoy it, I think is, kind of using the word normal. I really try to shy away from, and as well as, you know, forcing people into one box or the other, saying that they should like something or shouldn't, we tend to shy away from. But I think that it can be a massive additive to one sex life, their overall sexual experience, health, intimacy, and connection with their partner. If they're both willing to go there, there's so much exploration that can happen in that place as opposed to just what we call vanilla sex or, you know, just penile-vaginal kind of missionary style. So I think the exploration part is a great component of it. I also think it creates a new level of intimacy when you're able to or willing to, you know, be completely open and raw with your partner, with your body. And that's all aspects of the body. So allowing your partner to go down on you and really look at you and your, you know, intimate spaces and places and parts of the body that people can often shy away from or feel embarrassed with, I think that can create another level of intimacy. And then the communication that needs to result from things like having good oral sex, such as, you know, faster, slower, I like this, I didn't like that, you know, that really, you know, pleasured me. Or so it can really bring you closer as far as your communication goes when you're able to play with that and experiment and have that communication during the process as well.
So men seem to be way more into oral sex than women. Do you know why that might be the case?
I don't know. I think that might be one of the myths. People think that men really want oral sex and women do not. I think that for the vast majority of women, they don't have orgasms from penile-vaginal intercourse or just intercourse in general, vaginal intercourse. So the majority of women only have orgasms through clitoral stimulation or the stimulation of the clitoral hood. So that often happens during foreplay. Most women would like, the average is 22 minutes of women would request foreplay. Obviously, that's not for every single time you have sex, but that's kind of the average that is said. So 22 minutes of foreplay, what is that encompassing? Is that using your hands? Is that using your mouth? And why is it 22 minutes? Is that women need longer to warm up in their brain? Or is it really leading more to the fact that women mostly have orgasms from that clitoral stimulation that results from foreplay? So if a man is giving a woman oral sex, for instance, then that she's far more likely to have an orgasm before penetration occurs and then maybe have a satisfaction level on that versus, you know, just having intercourse. And not really stoking the foreplay. But I think a lot of women have hang-ups around body image issues or whether they smell or how they look down there or those sorts of things. So it can be very uncomfortable for a lot of women. I think there's a lot of stigma around it. So sometimes it's just not talked about or it can be difficult for a woman to request. But I think as a large majority of women, that's where they find the majority of their pleasure.
So if a man said, you know, I love for my girlfriend or partner or wife to do blowjob on me, I can't seem to get her interested. What might be some tips that you have to help, you know, kind of get the woman engaged and interested?
I think that's, that's why we wrote the second part of the book or the last quarter of the book to really address some of those things. Like what if your partner's really not into it, but it's something that you really want to engage in? How do you have, how do you create a safe space to bring that up for your partner? So they're not feeling like they're being attacked or a demand is being made. How do you use the correct terminology, meaning like do you start with I feel statements? Do you use the sandwich technique, meaning do you start with something positive, then insert something that you would like to have or change within the sexual realm or add, and then end with something positive to help really cushion your need or your request? Does it involve fantasy exploration and really inserting that into fantasy life? Or is it about discussing your partner's hang-ups or insecurities around oral sex that may be the barrier to them getting on board? So there's a lot of that in the back half of the book to really help you explore that with your partner to open up those channels.
I'm just curious. I often hear about premature ejaculation for men. And so how can a man tell, you know, whether a lot of that is because of physiological factors versus psychological?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it can often stem from behavioral techniques. Mm. So we call them masturbatory habits or patterns, and that's how you masturbate. And sometimes for men, they've been masturbating in a certain way for so long that when they have partnered sex, if that's different from how they've been practicing, and the practice is the masturbation, and the playtime is with your partner, and you practice like you play. Mm. So if you now are having sex with your partner, and that is vastly different than how you've been practicing, then that can cause dissonance, cognitive behavioral dissonance, and that can cause problems such as premature ejaculation. So for instance, if a man is masturbating and he's only given himself a few minutes each time he masturbates from start to finish, then when he has partnered sex, that might be very difficult for him to last a lot longer because he's trained his body to behave in one way and then wanting it to perform in a different way in, you know, quote unquote, game time situations. So really when I work with clients as a sex therapist, it's really talking with the men about really a holistic approach to not just how they're masturbating in general, but what thoughts, what cognitions are they feeding during this process as well that might be adding to it. So it's actually quite a complicated issue that we come at from quite many different angles, but that is one thing that could contribute to premature ejaculation.
And I remember one of my clients, he would be talking with this woman for quite some time, for years, and a lot of the relationship is sort of long distance on the phone. And they haven't been able to be engaged in sexual connection because of his tendency, according to him, to, you know, ejaculate prematurely. And yet he was very reluctant to share this with his partner. And yet he said in the past, he had that problem, but not as much, because he was either able to find ways to pleasure her, or he was able to sort of prolong the erection. And yet with this, because he's very emotionally invested, that he seemed to have a lot of anxiety about sharing this struggle that he has. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's actually really common. I hear that a lot. And I really, really feel for men, because I feel like they often don't have the space, or they, you know, the safe space or a person that they can share these worries and concerns, as anxieties, and what makes them self-conscious, and really what makes them pull away from intimacy, which is massive. I mean, a lot of them are really yearning for intimate connection, both physically, emotionally, psychologically, but they create this wall or barrier between them and their partners because of things like performance anxiety or not being able to last long enough or things like that. And that really is sad. So I really urge men to seek out a sex therapist, like someone like myself, for instance, that they can talk to about this, and that we can work on things like that, because it is really common. And like I said, there's a multitude of things that can affect it. I mean, even taking things like antidepressants, for instance, they can actually help men to last longer in bed. Now, I'm not saying I'm a drug pusher and you should just take antidepressants and you'll be fine. Obviously, it's much more complicated than that. But there's just so many different ways that we can, you know, kind of attack the problem to help, so that barrier wall isn't there, as well as helping the men have the language in order to communicate these things to their partners without feeling intense level of shame and guilt around it.
Yeah. Are there things that he could tell, whether it's more physiological versus psychological?
There are certain tests that sometimes I'll get them to go to their GP and have conversations around. They can even get an array of tests such as, you know, testosterone and minerals and vitamins and all of those things tested. But in general, mostly premature ejaculation is linked more to behavioral and psychological versus something that's necessarily inherently built in your blood or in your body structure.
Yeah. Sex is a big part of a man's identity, and I would imagine having something like this can be quite inhibiting.
Oh, for sure, for sure. It can, it, like I said, there's a lot of shame and guilt attached to it, and a lot of performance anxiety for men attached to it, which is really, it's sad. Mm-hmm.
Another area I'm really curious is in terms of sexual fetish, especially men having sexual fetish. So at what point, you know, is it healthy and normal to have sexual fetishes versus at what point do we decide that it might be unhealthy and extreme?
I think in general, I mean, if we're looking at DSM diagnosis, so DSM would stand for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. There's a whole list of things on there that would say, you know, this is diagnosable, and now you have, you know, a psychological, you know, diagnosable issue. I tend not to go there with clients. Yeah. I think for the most part, when we're looking at fetishism, I think it's important to say, you know, is this a problem for you, and is this a problem for your partner or within your relationship? So if it's not a if it's not a problem, then it's not a problem. It really doesn't matter how much it's involved within their intimate life or their sex life in general, whether it's an object fetish or behavioral fetish. If it's not creating an issue, it's a non-issue. But when it starts to create problems, meaning the person can maybe only become aroused or ejaculate or have an orgasm when something is involved, and that's causing perhaps relational problems in their marriage or their relationship, then we need to start looking and deconstructing at, you know, what are some root causes and how can we minimize that? Can we use some cognitive behavioral techniques to kind of minimize that as well? So I think it's coming more from that approach than it is necessarily of, you know, a quantity kind of structure, I think, is the most helpful.
So you're saying, basically, if it's not a problem so much for each person, then it's not a big problem.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, obviously, as long as it's still safe and sane and consensual on all parties combined. Mm-hmm. But yes, if it's not a problem, then it's not.
What about if it's related to fishy even, or urine and things like that? Is that sort of verging on unhealthy fetishes?
I think it would maybe go into an unhealthy region if you were consuming someone's feces. So we call it scat or scat play. Mm-hmm. If there's a form of scat play where maybe you're consuming other people's excrement, and there could be some kind of like disease component to that, or illness component, then maybe, you know, we're testing the waters on that safe, sane, and consensual. Mm-hmm. Is it really safe? And having that conversation is obviously important, but we try not to stigmatize to say, well, if someone is into golden showers, for instance, which has to do more with urine, then that means that they're bad or they're sick or they're wrong. It's just their fetish. As long as they're doing it in a safe way and their partner's okay, then it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Pressing for that intensity, would that be a problem at some point? You know, would they need more and more and more intense to feel the satisfaction, to feel the pleasure?
Oftentimes when someone will get into a fetish or into a category that really turns them on, that sometimes they need that one up or that next hit to have the same kind of effect as it did to begin with. I mean, we often see that in pornography addiction, where somebody will, you know, start looking at porn and something that they saw initially that would make them orgasm and would be, you know, high levels of dopamine and, you know, all of these wonderful endorphins firing. After a while, it loses its pizzazz. and they need to search out something that's bigger or better, or something that maybe after a few months or a few years or a decade, they would never think that they would go into that region of pornography or that fetish, but they're constantly needing something more in order to get that same level of high. And that's not just for fetishism or pornography. That can be in a multitude of different areas, even within a marriage or a relationship. I mean, it tends to lose its pizzazz. And then where are you reaching to get that same level of high that you did when you first met your partner or you were first having sex with your partner? So it's multifaceted.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples in terms of sexual fetishes that some of your clients seek for support?
Well, I think the whole array of fetishes that you could possibly Google, I feel like I've dabbled and seen bits and pieces of clients come through the door with those majority of fetishes, I would say. I do get a lot of ABDL clients. So ABDL stands for adult baby diaper lovers. And I get a large percentage of that community that will come in. And oftentimes that has to do with relationship communication. So someone being into that fetish and their partner not wanting that or enjoying that as much. And then how do you communicate and how do you traverse those waters as far as, you know, what's okay and what's not and how much is brought into the bedroom versus not. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is around the relationship communication and counseling as opposed to just focusing on a specific fetish and then saying we need to fix that. So a large percentage of that as well. But like I said, you get the whole gamut of fetishism in the office.
And so I would imagine if someone is sort of, if fetishes are a big part of their sexuality and in the new relationship or new marriage, they're not able to communicate that. I guess that can create a lot of barrier, I would imagine.
Yes, definitely. We talk about barriers to intimacy, and then one is not being able to communicate or not having the words to communicate or not feeling like it's safe or you're able to communicate about a fetish or a sexual like or preference. That is a massive barrier to intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Men would tell me that they're not able to explore, different sexual aspects with their wives, even though it's a long-term marriage. So they're not able to engage in sexual intimacy very often, but yet they're able to fantasize, they even watch pornography. What might be some, you know, some tips for someone like that?
I think if they feel comfortable enough, seeking out a sex therapist and couples counselor would be a very massive an important step, because our only job, well, not only, but one of our main jobs is to create that space and get that conversation going so that it's able to happen and that discussion is able to happen in a way where one person doesn't feel shamed or attacked or another one feels pushed to do something they're not comfortable with or those sorts of things. So I think that that can be a really big help in not only getting the conversation going, but really making progress on those sorts of things. If they do reach a stumbling block where they feel like they've expressed all of this and their partner has really just, you know, put down their foot and said, this is the hill I'm willing to die on, you know, I'm not doing this, this is never happening, then oftentimes seeking individual counseling for how does that affect you? Are you able to still stay in a marriage or a relationship where you're not able to express your full intimate self? If you do want to stay, how does that come out for you? Where are you filtering those desires, those fantasies, you know, those actions in ways that you or your partner deem appropriate? So having those conversations through individual counseling would also be helpful. Mm-hmm.
What might that look like if somebody has an addiction to pornography? At what point do we decide, you know, watching porn is a normal part of a person's life versus when it's become a problem or addiction?
I think kind of like when we touched on with the fetishism, I think when it starts to become a problem within the relationship or for the person, then it's a problem. So, for instance, if they are missing work to stay home and masturbate and watch porn, if they are not going to social functions or hanging out with friends, you know, if their, you know, work, life, and relationships are suffering because they're putting too much of this time or attention towards watching pornography or masturbating, then it sounds like it's become an issue and then we need to tackle it. So it's not necessarily that, you know, watching porn is generally bad or masturbating is bad, but it's the quantity of that and what you are taking away from or what is maybe suffering because of this activity or the quantity of this activity, for instance. So it's really addressing it in that kind of lens, within that lens.
So what might be challenges with watching porn in terms of the impact on the relationship?
Well, I think that generally, I often hear that, let's say I'll use a male-focused mm-hmm. example, yeah. but if a man is pulling away from his partner or his wife and no longer wanting to have sex with her or initiating sex anymore because it's easier to masturbate or it's easier to watch porn or it's quicker or, you know, they feel frustrated in their intimate relationship or bored with it, therefore they're focusing all or most of their attention towards pornography and masturbation versus with their partner, and then that's causing problems within the relationship. That is often something that you hear. Or a man has lost his ability to get an erection with his partner or keep an erection with his partner or ejaculate with his partner. Or maybe they have delayed ejaculation or premature ejaculation because of excessive pornography watching or masturbatory habits. So it's kind of looking at a scope of all of those sorts of things.
Yeah. What might be some benefits of watching porn?
There can be an array of benefits. So oftentimes women that will come in, for instance, that are pre-orgasmic, mm-hmm. so are having troubles reaching orgasm, some erotica or erotic forms of media like pornography, certain types, can be very beneficial for the educational component. So teaching a woman how to pleasure herself, for instance, there's a massive component of that. There's also, you know, exploring fantasy life for couples or for individuals to help, you know, bring a spark back in or get that conversation going. It can also be helpful in learning, you know, things such as it's okay to have sex in different positions or in different places, or, you know, some women really love oral sex, whether it's giving or receiving. So some messages sent through pornography can be helpful. There's obviously lots that are not helpful that perpetuate myths, but pornography can be a helpful tool.
Okay. And in terms of for men, how can it be helpful?
I think a lot of the same ways, mm-hmm. you know, so education in some facets, getting the conversation going, fantasy exploration, outlets in general, it can be very helpful for. So it can be the same for men and women.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How important are fantasies for couples?
Fantasy life is very important. The vast majority of people do fantasize, yeah. whether it's while they're masturbating or sometimes while they're having sex with their partner, and that's normal and it's fine. And so having those discussions around fantasy and really what does it for you can be a very bonding experience for couples.
And that was Dr. Tisha Morgan, and she has recently written a book called Heads Up, a book that is aimed to demystify and destigmatize oral sex. So for more information about her book, go to her website, headsupbook.com. Now I want to share with you another TED Talk titled, Why I Stopped Watching Porn. And this is a perspective from a man sharing his thoughts about the negative impact of porn and pornography on our society as a whole and on our sexual and emotional intimacy and how we view women. So here is the TED Talk, Why I Stopped Watching Porn.
I stopped watching porn for two reasons, basically. The first one was that porn brought so much anger and violence into my private fantasies. And these were anger and violence that were not there originally to begin with. And I did not want that for me anymore. This was not me, and I decided to just put an end to it. Easier said than done. I'll get to it later. But the second reason was that I came to realizing, I think, that only by watching porn, I take part in creating a demand for filmed prostitution, because that's what porn really is, filmed prostitution. Porna stands for prostitute, grafia stands for documentation, and prostitution was nobody's childhood dream, okay? It is always a result of trouble and distress. Now, I became aware of that gradually when I was volunteering with men and women in prostitution, some of them victims of human traffic, serving aid in brothels, under the bridge, in street corners, but you don't really need to do all that in order to understand how this mechanism of porn and prostitution works. Because porn as a genre, it's not about erotica or healthy sexual communication. It is all about male domination of women, subordinance of women, not only as a sexual practice, as a way of being, as a genderial hierarchy in this world. Like, if we would ask porn, if we were to ask porn, how does it define something as sexual? What qualifies, what defines something as sexual? Porn would laugh in our face. What defines sexual? Whatever men find arousing. Men find it arousing to choke a woman, to have brutal sex without one touch, hug, kiss, tender caress. Well, then it is sexual. It arouses men to see a woman or a child cry. It is sexual. It arouses men to rape a woman. Well, then it is sexual. In every mainstream porn gallery on the web, we can find the rape category, side by side with the humiliation category, abuse category, crying category, and so on. And this is all as if regular porn is not already filled with these motives. Even in its mildest version, the mildest version of porn, what porn is showing us, like, I don't know, 80, maybe 90% of the time, is actually sex with no hands involved. And this is not how we authentically desire. Sorry, I'll repeat that. I see your look. Sex with no hands involved. Okay. If you're not going to give up watching porn, so next time you do watch, just notice that porn cameras have no interest in capturing any normal sensual activity, such as petting, caressing, making out, touching, hugging, kissing. No. What porn cameras are into is the penetration. So normally, the composition will be a man and a woman. Hopefully just one. Okay, so one man and one woman. His penis is inside her. Don't be picky, it doesn't matter where inside. Somewhere inside her there is a penis. His penis is somewhere inside her, okay? And in order to not block the camera for doing this extreme close-up on the penetration, he's standing with his hands behind his back most of the time. And the woman is in this uncomfortable position, and she needs to handle the penis inside her without damaging the hair or makeup work done on her, because that's money invested and time invested in her, without disturbing his aggressive movement, and mainly without blocking the camera. So the result is that we got two people having sex, different shapes and acrobatics or something, but they're having sex when the only body parts that actually touch each other are the penis and the part being penetrated. No hands involved. Now, I talk, I don't know, 250, 300 times a year, soldiers, students, pupils. No one has ever come up to me and say, Ran, you know, that part with sex with no hand thing, that was my authentic desire. Like, when I was 11 or 12, I never wanted to kiss anybody or touch them. I was not curious about that. It was all penetration to begin with. No one has ever said that. Before porn. After porn. In my private fantasies before watching porn, there was always a very strong narrative. And the narrative was of sensuality and mutuality, which means that I had always imagined what I will say to her. What would she possibly answer? What options do I have to respond? In real life, it never works like I planned, but it was super important in my mind in terms of arousal, the build-up, the location, the setting, where will it be? What are the circumstances of me and her being all alone all of a sudden? How will this bodily inflaming between us will emerge step by step? It was super important. Before porn. After making a habit out of porn, it conquers your mind and it invades your brain, and I lost my ability to imagine, which means I found myself, and I won't be too explicit, but trying to masturbate, just closing my eyes, trying to fantasize desperately about something human and not making it because my head was bombarded with all those images of women being violated and subordinated and forced into pretending they enjoy diabolic sperm rituals, okay? So, this is pretty much the result. And we are all vulnerable to pornography. It's not just young people. And we should be very careful, I think, with not only what we put into our bodies, but in terms of food and nutrition, in what is the nutrition of our mind? Because everything we watch invades us. I'll give you a short example from non-sexual areas. I came back home and my beloved one was watching some cultural junk. She was watching a karaoke show, auditions, the one with the chairs spinning. And we don't have a TV set back home, okay? We don't have a TV set back home, but only because it allows us to falsely present ourselves as deep and profound people. I never heard of that. Mastectomy, who? Angelina, we don't have a TV. We watch every cultural junk possible, okay? Not me, not her, we don't contemplate about l'existence. We download stuff, and we download all cultural junk. So I'm watching this 20 minutes karaoke show, and it was so boring and tedious, okay? 2 minutes talking, 4 minutes blabbering about it. I lost patience after like 20 minutes, and I went off to take a shower. And the most interesting part was in the shower, because what I found out there was myself in my most pathetic ever. I'm going to share it with you. I want to feel that you actually accept me and love me, so I have to share my most pathetic, and you have to accept it now. I don't know, until I got over myself, if it took me, I don't know, 5, 7, 10 minutes to realize that I'm standing under the water in the shower, pondering severely, what would have been my song for the auditions? Deep and profound, mind you. I won't be doing this Rihanna, Lady Gaga, I'll be doing Mercedes Sosa, Como un pájaro libre. I'll be doing a cover for Bob Dylan's Blind Willie McTell. Ain't that deep and profound? I had to realize that I'm an idiot because I have no talent for music. More than that, I never wanted to be neither a musician nor a singer-songwriter. This was never a part of my inner world of wishes. Okay, but I'm a human being. What can I do? I was watching that for 20 minutes. It entered my brain for a while. So if we take this example and we just try to measure or estimate the impact of 20 minutes of watching no matter what, how it invades our mind and conquer our wantings and desires, let's just try to imagine, or I can share with you orally, what is the impact of 20 minutes of watching porn once, twice a week, nothing unmoderated? It's overtaking. And porn is in our households, whether we want it or not, and I believe that it does not agree with our well-being. And because we have internet in the Western world all over the place, almost in every cellular phone now, we've got 90% of 12-year-olds watching porn on a regular basis. And it has both an addictive effect and a paralyzing effect. It's addictive because we develop somewhat of a dependency in porn, but the paralyzing part is because, mainly for young boys and men, because porn is teaching us that as a man, you are solely valued in sex by having a large penis and an eternal erection. According to porn, being a valuable sexual partner does not relate with being sensual, passionate, attentive, generous, well-coordinated, none of the above. It is all about large penis and eternal sunshine, which we don't possess. So boys become paralyzed, and if they don't become paralyzed by watching porn, very often they turn into imitators of what they saw, which means they become aggressors. Aggressors, even when emotion is involved. Like, there is so much sexual abuse going on nowadays within the confines of what we perceive from the outside as beautiful teenage love stories or healthy adult relationships, because we don't really talk about sex. We just see it all over the place. We don't really talk about it. So what goes on in the confines of a certain room, but these are all sexual mutations that happens. If we talk about women, it's not only that, but young girls and women get the message, not only from hardcore porn, but from our porn-influenced mainstream culture. Have you seen any Miley Cyrus, Lady Gaga video clip, commercials? That's porn with clothes on it. So girls get this notion that if you want to be worthy of love, first and foremost, you have to be worthy of sexual desire. And now, the definition of sexual desire almost equals be like a porn star. So I work in dozens and dozens of high schools and junior highs. In every single one of these schools, I find girls that at a certain point agreed to be documented in an intimate situation because they wanted to please some guy that they had feelings for. And this guy misappropriated their trust. Always same story, so he sells it on WhatsApp application or on the web, in the internet. And normally nobody even addresses him in terms of moral. But it is always girls that suffer from shaming and mortification. They can change school, they drop out normally. Change school, move to another city and still be haunted on social networks. They develop clinical depressions, severe eating disorders, as if we don't have enough reasons in our culture to develop eating disorders. They become so isolated socially. So some of them, like Amanda Todd, rest in peace, some of them actually commit suicide because they find no more value in life or in themselves. So porn is not only in our house, it is a capital case. It is not a minor phenomenon in our society. It is a question of life and death sometimes. It is mainly a question of life and death for the people who participate in porn, because porn is not an embodiment of freedom of speech, freedom of occupation, blah, blah, blah. No, it's an embodiment of sex exploitation working side by side with human traffic, raping, pimping, solicitation. For every one porn star with a book contract or a production company, we've got hundreds of thousands of women and girls who does not survive out there. Literally, they just don't make it. The sex industry just, how do you say, chews them up and spits them back into brothels, into hooking in the street, escorting, massage parlors with happy or unhappy ending, depends who you ask. And I'm not joking, this is serious life. This is the whole spectrum of prostitution. So many of them doesn't even make it to the age of 50. I'm talking countries that the average life expectancy is 75, 76 years now. They don't make it to the age of 50. Four reasons mainly. Drugs, STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, being murdered by a John, a pimp, a boyfriend. And the fourth reason is suicide once again. Because if you're a prostitute, on camera or off camera, you're in the situation that we can refer to as social death. We have all sat in the dinner table with people who probably consumed prostitution, that have been to a brothel once, twice, at least. We never sat down to the table with a prostitute, not with a declared one. So that's social death. It is not glamorous, not at all. And when I sit in the privacy of my room and I watch porn, even without paying, no need to pay, it's free, okay? I hope you know that, if you're still consuming. Whatever I am watching is creating a demand, and wherever there is a demand, there will be supply. There's a correlation. If I watch pornography of black older women, somebody is going to go out and pimp black older women. Asian minors, somebody is already trafficking Asian minors in order to film them, okay? Israeli women, Palestinian women, WASP, All-American College Girls, that are strong in the last few years. It's a very upcoming category. The scum of the earth are already out there trying to solicitate and prostitute these women on camera. So I stopped watching porn for my personal well-being, my intimate communication, my private erotic life, my, you know, reclaiming control and responsibility over my mind. But by doing that, I actually stopped contributing to this horrible sex industry, and that's a good thing to do, I believe. And I would really like to propose that notion of physically and emotionally safe sex. Emotionally safe sex. It does not mean going back to be conservative or unliberated sexually. I'm all for sexual freedom. It just means that we need to put genderial hierarchy aside, subordinates aside, and bring back in, let's just say, laughter as a critical mass for intimacy. Two souls, two humans, two souls alone in private. Can they please have a laugh together? I don't care if they know each other for a decade or for an hour. If two souls alone in a room does not manage to have a laugh together, what good could possibly grow there, sexual and non-sexual? That's emotionally safe sex. I've got so many things I really want to share with you, but I feel like my time is almost up. So I just really want to ask for us to speak about these issues more, because I strongly feel that our history of silence never did us any good, because silence only perpetuates more silence, while talking normally gives birth to more talking, more sharing, more identification, more awareness, more change. Small change in our small, humble life, but real change, a true one, emotionally safer. Thank you for listening.
This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour, hosted by Quinn Leigh Erickson, every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time. For more information about Quinn, visit www.quinle.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and you have a beautiful, restful sleep. Good night.